Hello and welcome to the European Respiratory Society podcast, a regular feature of the ERS Respiratory Channel. My name is Rufika Hamutcu Ersu, and I'm very happy to be leading today's discussion on morbidity in the obese child with obstructive sleep apnea. To give you some background, I'm currently professor of pediatrics at the University of Ottawa, Canada, and director of the sleep laboratory and home ventilation program at the Children's Hospital of Eastern Ontario, Division of Pediatric Respirology. My specialist areas are pediatric respirology and sleep medicine. And my research mainly focuses on the epidemiology and diagnosis of sleep disordered breathing in children. I am also the current chair-elect of the European Respiratory Society's Pediatric Physiology and Sleep Group. Joining me in this discussion is Professor Stan Verhulst. Stan is a professor of pediatrics at the University of Antwerp, Belgium, and head of the Department of Pediatrics at the Antwerp University Hospital. He is specialized in pediatric pulmonology and sleep medicine. His research mainly focuses on the complications and management of sleep disordered breathing in children, with a special interest in obese children. He was co-chair of a European Respiratory Society task force on obstructive sleep apnea in children and one on non-invasive ventilation in children. Due to the COVID-19 pandemic, we were not able to meet face-to-face for this discussion.
Welcome, Stan.
Thank you, Rufika, for the nice introduction. And it's always good to talk to you and to exchange ideas, I think, about a very important topic. I've been studying obstructive sleep apnea in children for a very long time. Since 2004, I started my scientific career on that topic, specifically on sleep apnea in obese children, which I think is very important, not only from a clinical point of view, but also from a research point of view. And I think still an area where we have a lot of work to cover.
So why do you think obesity is relevant for children with obesity?
Well, I don't have to tell you that we have an epidemic of weight issues in children, probably also increasing due to the COVID pandemic, but overweight, obesity in children are so prevalent, and they're becoming more and more important because you see adult types of complications, you see them appearing during childhood. You have problems like endothelial dysfunction, hypertension, dyslipidemia, high cholesterol levels, insulin resistance, diabetes type 2. And in between, you also have obstructive sleep apnea moving into that picture. You know that it is very prevalent in obese children. And as we are more and more seeing, it can also interact with obesity in making several of these complications more likely to appear. So in my opinion, obesity and obstructive sleep apnea often go hand in hand together and making a lot, and they're having a lot of joint complications, which of course complicate the life of these children as well.
So you think the obesity actually augments the consequences of obstructive sleep apnea in children?
I think that's an interesting viewpoint, and I think it's very difficult to see which way are they interacting. Is it the obesity that augments obstructive sleep apnea complications, or is it obstructive sleep apnea that augments the obesity-related complication? And that's a very difficult thing to study, but I don't know if that's really matters in clinical practice. I think what is very important for us as pediatricians is that we know and that we need to know that obstructive sleep apnea is a very prevalent comorbidity in obese children. You know the figures, it can go from 20% to more than 50%. So it's frequently observed in these children. And we know that if you have obstructive sleep apnea, then it can augment different kind of cardiovascular and metabolic complications. So it definitely goes away from obstructive sleep apnea towards obesity, probably also the other way around. So I think it's more that we kind of have to see it like a vicious circle, that they can strengthen each other in a negative way. But I think as a first important message, I think it's very important that we as clinicians, if we encounter an obese child, that we are alert for the presence of obstructive sleep apnea, and that we have to see it from the holistic approach, that it's not just obstructive sleep apnea, that it's not just obesity. Probably they're both part of a spectrum and they can interact towards each other.
Thanks, Stan. That's so nicely put for a very complicated issue. But how do we break this vicious cycle? Do we just treat any obese child with an adenotonsillectomy that we would otherwise treat a child who is otherwise healthy without obesity? Or do we take a different approach?
Also, I think a very interesting, but also a very difficult discussion. In our center, we have always advocated that you do not routinely select adenotonsillectomy for this type of children. You have to be sure that that would be the correct treatment. And I know that probably in other centers, I think especially in the US, they will have a different type of approach. I don't know what's your experience in Canada or the United States? How do they approach this type of children?
So I think the routine would be, if they have adenotonsillar hypertrophy, still first go with the adenotonsillectomy, but be aware that there is a very high risk for persistent obstructive sleep apnea post-surgery. Especially these children will still gain weight after surgery because now they're not as active as would the other children without obesity, and that would also increase the likelihood of either persistence or recurrence. So maybe follow these children not only clinically, but with a sleep study and have a high threshold of suspicion for persistence or recurrence. I think that would be the current approach, and choose a positive airway pressure support, either a CPAP or a BiPAP if there is hypoventilation.
I think you touched some very important and some critical points as well. There are several studies out there that have clearly shown that if you remove the tonsils and the adenoids, that you have the risk that these children will gain weight. I don't think that we understand the mechanisms completely, but could be because they have less energy expenditure during sleep. I think that's one of the more logical complications. And you always have the jokes that it is because of the ice cream they get after the adenotonsillectomy. I don't think that will be one of the main reasons, but I think that's one of the very critical conclusions, that if you send these children for adenotonsillectomy, do not lose them, keep them in follow-up, and do not focus only on their obstructive sleep apnea. You can send them to ENT, but also include them in parallel to a weight management program, because they have a risk of increasing weight after the surgery. And don't let them out of your sight. Keep them in follow-up so that you know how they're doing on their weight status, on their BMI evolution. Because if they increase in BMI, you can be sure that their sleep apnea will get back or will get worse. That being put aside, I think that it's also time that we move forward and that we are absolutely sure that if you have an obese child with obstructive sleep apnea, that you have to be absolutely sure that when you send him for adenotonsillectomy, that it is indicated. And we have certain procedures. I think the most well-known and the most performed is the drug-induced sleep endoscopy. Some centers are doing the CINE MRI, the MRI scan during sleep, but that you can clearly identify the anatomical regions that are responsible for obstructive sleep apnea in that individual child. Is it the adenoids? Is it the tonsils? Then you can go on with adenotonsillectomy. But is it something else? Then I don't think that adenotonsillectomy is the right answer for that individual child. How do you think about that viewpoint?
That's great. That's very helpful. I think I want to ask you about your opinion on the role of weight loss it's always easier said than done. And I know you have some experience with the inpatient weight loss programs. This has been quite well published by your group. What's your opinion on that? Is this sustainable in the long term? It's not always feasible, but is it sustainable? Also, what's your opinion about bariatric surgery in those children with many comorbidities? Yeah.
Well, I think when weight loss succeeds, it's a formidable therapy for this type of children, because you will not only cure their obstructive sleep apnea, but you will, of course, improve their obesity, and you will improve many other obesity-related complications. So it is, I think, today in children, the only treatment where you can tackle all these issues. We have some good data in Belgium about non-invasive weight loss. We have the opportunity here to send these children to an inpatient weight management program. They stay there for 6 to 12 months. They go to school there, but any minute of free time is spent with physical activity, with doing sports. There's a dietitian to improve that side as well. And we know that when you lose a certain amount of weight, the success percentage also for reducing or improving or getting rid of their obstructive sleep apnea is also very good. What we don't really have, I think, in pediatrics is what do we get about outpatient weight management therapy, where, of course, the amounts of weight loss that you can get is much smaller than inpatient programs or compared to bariatric surgery. I think that's something that's missing. And what we also know is when the patients are discharged from that inpatient weight management program, their weight, it goes up again. We know that it stays below their initial BMI, but it goes up again. And we're not sure about what that means for their obstructive sleep apnea. And that's something that we are currently studying. We are doing long-term studies on these patients, looking at the long-term effects of weight loss, weight management, weight regain on their obstructive sleep apnea. So I think we will have to repeat this podcast in 2 to 3 years, and hopefully we will have answers then. A little bit in parallel, I think with bariatric surgery, some studies there in adolescents, again, a lot of weight loss can be achieved, which is beneficial for obstructive sleep apnea. Personally, I don't have clinical experience with bariatric surgery, because in our country, in Belgium, bariatric surgery today is only reimbursed from the age of 18 and onwards. So that's something for my adult colleagues. I think it's different in the US and Canada. Perhaps you can talk about that a little bit.
So I think there are a couple centers that are doing this more than others. I don't have a personal experience either. That's something I think still considered an extreme sort of measure. But like you said, there are a couple of studies, including adolescents, and showed success in improving the obstructive sleep apnea, at least the severity, significant weight loss. But I think these children also have other comorbidities. It's not only obstructive sleep apnea, but that's very important, I think, for the future studies also to include obstructive sleep apnea. As you mentioned, there are some studies looking at adolescents and bariatric surgery, but didn't really look at the presence or absence of obstructive sleep apnea. So this is something important to monitor as an outcome measure in those children as well. So I also maybe want to comment a little bit on DICE. I know your center is doing DICE in children who are surgery naive. So in other words, as an evaluation, like you just mentioned. And I know you published some papers looking at the success in otherwise healthy children, if the DICE would help to improve the outcome.
I think in general, we have very good experience with sleep endoscopy. And it really changed our clinical practice. I think every child with obstructive sleep apnea, which is seen by our multidisciplinary team, we are there, a pediatric pulmonologist, but together with our pediatric ENTs, they will get DICE, and the type of treatment will depend on what we see during the sleep endoscopy, because we strongly believe that if the DICE doesn't show a pattern of adenotonsillar collapse, then adenotonsillectomy will not do any good to that child, and it's better to select another type of treatment. I think specific for obese children, I think we still need some more work there. We had a retrospective study, I think that was published this year or in 2020. Very interesting there. We compared the pattern of upper airway collapse in obese children, overweight children, and then normal weight children. And what was really interesting was that the higher the BMI was, the more these children expressed what we call the circumferential collapse of the upper airway, showing perhaps that the fat deposition around the upper airway, that it shows a more concentric collapse of the entire upper airway. So probably that these children, either they need to have weight loss, certainly, but if they have really obstructive sleep apnea, then of course you will not only need weight loss, but then these children will be a candidate for CPAP therapy. But I think that DICE is a safe, it's a reliable technique that can really help us as clinicians to select the most appropriate treatment. That being said, and I think you know that also, and we discussed about it, is we don't have randomized controlled trials comparing DICE-directed treatment versus only adenotonsillectomy and see which one is associated with a better outcome. We discussed it in our center. I think going back and do a randomized controlled trial and do not do DICE anymore in a group of that patients, I think for us it would be ethically difficult to do that, but we still need, I think, this kind of studies to really identify the importance of DICE in children. And I think you know that we are thinking about comparing the outcomes of centers that use DICE versus centers that don't use DICE and compare the outcomes of surgery in these type of children. But I really think that's one step that we need to do to move our field forward.
Thank you. That's really progressive. And I think it's a way to go to improve the outcomes. We cannot just give one sort of treatment to every child. It's a good way to personalize the surgical approach and then maybe not do a surgery, be more conservative in a particular child, or maybe combine therapies based on those findings. So it doesn't only direct the surgery, but it directs the whole treatment, and it's very progressive, which brings us to CPAP. And of course, in adults, if you have an obstructive sleep apnea, diagnosed with either clinical symptoms, excessive daytime sleepiness, snoring, then maybe you have obstructive sleep apnea that's clinically diagnosed, or you have a home sleep study or a polysomnography. In children, we do recommend polysomnography or home polygraphy if there's a lack of resource for polysomnography, or even just the symptoms as well, from the task force that we have worked on together for children with obstructive sleep apnea. So in adults, the way to go is a CPAP. In children, way to go is an adenotonsillectomy, which you have now alluded to. So how about the particular points about the use of CPAP in children? What's your clinical experience? Are they different than the whole other children with comorbidities such as Down syndrome, Prader-Willi, or is it pretty much the same, just low adherence?
I think CPAP in obese children with obstructive sleep apnea, especially obese teenagers, it's a challenge. I think also something peculiar about sleep apnea in the obese child or adolescent, most of the times it's relatively mild. You cannot compare it with an adult who have an index, let's say about 60 or 70. That's something that we do not often see in the obese teenager with obstructive sleep apnea. They have an index of 8 or 10. And most of the times, they do not have real clinical symptoms associated with or specific for their obstructive sleep apnea. So a lot of patients that we have followed or that I have followed, when you put the CPAP on them, it's not always that they feel a clear and immediate benefit during the next couple of days. So as is the same as it is with weight loss and weight management, the adherence to CPAP therapy can be an issue in obese teenagers. And then you have the difficult clinical decision, the obese adolescent, he doesn't tolerate his CPAP. What do we do? We have, of course, school books examples of children who wear their CPAP perfectly, also teenagers, but you will encounter a lot of obese teenagers as well, where adherence is an issue. And then I think it becomes difficult about what to do. In our country, we have the possibility of that inpatient treatment centers. And of course, we have to convince the parents, we have to convince the patient to go there for 6 to 12 months, which is not always easy. But I think that also there, weight loss, weight management therapy, it becomes a very important player as well, especially in those children who are CPAP intolerant and are no candidates for surgery. But it can give rise to difficult clinical decision-making. I don't know how you see it.
Yeah, I completely agree. If they don't have daytime symptom improvement, I think even the parents are not that crazy about using their PAP therapy. There are some maybe strategies to help them to wear maybe peer support groups,
yes,
and really having them understand why they're using their PAP machine, really troubleshoot what's, you know, bugging them. Is it the mask or is it the pressure using a ramp? And those kind of strategies that we all try to do our best, and having a CPAP nurse and having maybe some closer follow-up. Yeah. But there are still going to be some teenagers with obesity who just don't want to wear them. It's bugging them. So what would be your threshold really for pushing it? So in our task force, we said at least moderate obstructive sleep apnea or mild to moderate, but with some consequence. So that could be either enuresis or high blood pressure and so forth. But maybe like 5 is too low of a threshold. What's your personal threshold to really push the PAP therapy use?
Yeah, I absolutely agree with all the measures that you mentioned. I think it's very important in CPAP or non-invasive ventilation in general that you do that with the entire team, that you have the patient involved, the parents involved, that you have behavioral therapy, CPAP nurse, psychological support, and so on. I think very important and very critical to a pediatric CPAP program. When it doesn't work, it's always difficult. I think we have several children with an index between 5 and 10, where we just, with a normal oxygen saturation, not severe desaturation, that we say, okay, let's wait and let's put all our energy in trying to lose weight and see what happens. But I think sometimes you have to be realistic and sometimes it doesn't work. And then I think we have to find other solutions. I think what we are researching now is, can we identify additional treatment options, antioxidants, anti-inflammatory medication, what so on, which tackle or improve many of the OSA-related complications. A lot, you know, that a lot of obstructive sleep apnea, it generates systemic inflammation. In specific to obesity, it could probably also induce some changes in the adipose tissue. So what we are doing now is trying to identify certain molecules that can be added to the treatment in order to lessen the obstructive sleep apnea-related complications. We mainly did that because we saw, for instance, that when you have an obese child with obstructive sleep apnea, they will have endothelial dysfunction. On baseline, it's mainly the obesity that drives the endothelial dysfunction. However, when these children lose weight but still have persistent obstructive sleep apnea, these children will have worse endothelial function compared to an obese child whose sleep apnea has disappeared after weight loss. And we really want to tackle that first group with the persistent obstructive sleep apnea with kind of anti-inflammatory or antioxidant molecules to try to improve the inflammation and the other metabolic and cardiovascular complication. I think that's something in our field that is a little bit missing, which additional treatment options, not specific for sleep apnea, but something that can improve the obstructive sleep apnea related complications. And I think that's a very interesting area to study, but can also be possibly very clinical relevant as well.
I agree. I think that's a very, again, forward thinking, because our worry is always what the future holds for these children with obstructive sleep apnea. Are they going to become adults who continue to have obstructive sleep apnea and have all these cardiovascular consequences and increase the burden both on personal and society health resource points? So that would be also a forward thinking to treat these children, so at least they will not have those consequences. I want to ask maybe one last question. What is your opinion on combination of treatments for these children? Then maybe like looking at the positional therapy, orthodontic treatments, anti-inflammatory, if really they're not tolerating the CPAP, or maybe even if they are, using the CPAP machines as a bridge, because this may be a lifelong commitment for these children. It's hard to tell them, right? Like how long they're going to use it unless they lose weight. What's your opinion on those?
Well, I think the patients and the parents know the obesity is a chronic disease, period. And obstructive sleep apnea in that context probably is also a chronic disease. And I think our field is moving towards multidisciplinary treatments and selecting one or a combination of treatments that works for the individual patient. In the context of obesity, I think it's already a combination treatment because you always will need the weight management program plus another treatment specific for moderate to severe obstructive sleep apnea. That can be CPAP, that can be surgery, that can be orthodontics, that can be a positional device if you have a child with positional sleep apnea. Perhaps in the future, it can be some kind of anti-inflammatory medication. But I think, and I know a lot of our colleagues are working that way, we have multidisciplinary sleep clinics now. We have us as pediatricians, we have our ENT colleagues, we have our orthodontics, the maxillofacial surgeon, dietitian, psychological support, CPAP nurses. So I think our field is becoming more and more complex because we get a wider array of treatment options. But I think that's just a sign that we are taking this seriously and that we are treating our children the way they should be treated. And I think it's very important for us to keep our adult colleagues showing, but also our funding agencies showing that obstructive sleep apnea in children, it's not just a problem of adenoids and tonsils. It's not just a problem of the snoring toddler with a lot of ENT infections. No, it's a problem that we should take seriously because it can be a chronic disease and because it can have an impact on many other organs as well.
Thank you so much, Stan.
I don't want to sound too heavy, but I think that's a very important message.
Agree. And then maybe prevention of obesity in children for the public health authorities, just to prevent all these, increasing activity, healthy living is a big task. We're dealing with the consequences. And we'll continue to do so to do the best for the future of our society, for the future of our children.
Yeah.
But need help really to prevent this from happening.
Yeah, I totally agree. And I'm not saying that we don't need to study obesity or obstructive sleep apnea in adults or in the elderly, but it starts during childhood and the prevention of obesity, very important. And I mean, we are always looking for funds and new research ideas, but I think these are real clinical and research priorities about the prevention of obstructive sleep apnea, the importance of a healthy sleep, about healthy breathing during sleep. I think it's really important that we also in the ERS and other societies that we really keep on putting the children first.
Thank you so much, Stan, for all this really helpful, clinically relevant information. It was a pleasure.
Very welcome. Always a pleasure talking to you.
Thank you for joining us for this ERS podcast. It has been a pleasure to be involved. And thank you to Professor Stan Verhulst for his contributions and insights on the topic. You can visit the ERS Respiratory Channel each month for more podcasts featuring discussions between experts on the latest hot topics in respiratory medicine.